Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Authors Access, where authors get published and published authors get successful. Hi, this is Irene Watson, and I am the managing editor of Reader Views, and I'm in Austin, Texas.
And I'm Victor Volkman from Loving Healing Press in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Our show is recorded live every Thursday at 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. It's Thursday, June 21st, 2007, and welcome to episode number 30 in our series. Tonight's topic is Becoming Your Own Critique Partner, and our special guests who will be joining us this hour are Janet Walters and Jane Toombs. You can learn more about our guests on the Authors Access website, which is authorsaccess.com.
And I'd like to take a moment to remind all of our listeners about the new show, Authors Airwaves, which features a different author lecture, reading, or interview every week at www.authorsairwaves.com. Look forward to seeing you there as well.
Now tonight we're on the line with both Janet Walters and Jane Toombs. Janet Walters is both nurse and novelist. She has published 28 novels and 4 nonfiction books over a 30-year writing career. 3 of these were written as ghostwriter. Janet has written in many genres, including romances, contemporary, and historical. She has written paranormal and fantasies, cozy mysteries, and suspense novels. In 2003, she wrote Becoming Your Own Critique Partner with Jane Toombs and won the Epi for nonfiction, which brings us to Jane Toombs. Jane is the author of some 80 published books and 15 or so novellas and short stories. She writes in all genres except for men's action and erotica, though paranormal is her favorite to read and write. And now we're going to go to this week's special guests, Janet Lane Walters and Jane Toombs. Good evening to the both of you.
Good evening.
Hi. Wow. So as I'm listening to Victor talking about you and Jane, my goodness, 80-some published books. Now we are talking to an expert here. My goodness. So before we go any further, I really would like to have an explanation what becoming your own critique partner really means.
Okay, what it means is many people find a critique group, other authors, and they help each other with things. Sometimes you're in places where you can't find someone to do this, or the people you find don't write this sort of thing you do. So the book is designed to help people take their manuscript apart and look at the different elements and put it together to make it a selling book.
Yes, and it also helps with editing your book when you're ready to send it in.
I'm just having a hard time kind of getting the big picture of how I can actually write a manuscript and then be able to, let's say, edit myself, because I've written it and I know it, and soon I'm just reading what's not even in there or what is in there. And so how do you actually become this other entity within yourself that can edit your own work?
Okay, we have checklists at the end of each chapter, which go into, like, the first one is show, not tell, and you look at your dialogue and your narrative to see if you've shown and not told. And we do this with every one of the things. There are also exercises that you can look at the writings of other people and analyze them and look at your own and compare.
And there are 21 chapters, so each element of a book is covered.
So what are some of the elements?
The critique partner right here, and here is the, your tell needs showing. Listen to the mockingbird. Is your black moment really gray? Is this scene necessary? Modifying to death. Just the senses, ma'am. Do you gallop when you should stroll? Don't follow the bouncing head. Can this plot be saved? The lean, mean writing machine. False starts. We've heard that song before. Drowning in detail. This isn't Kansas Toto. In the mood. The song is you. It's a long, long time from May to December. Why did he do that? Dropped eyes at Heartbreak Hotel.
So let's just pick one of those. For instance, the song is you. And
well, she was taking the song is you. Now, the song is you discusses your voice and what you put into your book.
Right. They're always talking about an author's voice. This is part of it.
Okay, and so when we talk about voice, what is it that you really mean when you're talking about the writer's voice?
Okay, I had this addressed the other day because some of my people said, no matter what you write, Janet, we can tell It's you. Even though when you write suspense, you have a different pacing, but there's something about it that says, it's me who wrote it. And I don't know exactly how you can define voice, because this is something each person has to find on their own.
But we do make suggestions so that you can help find your own voice in all of most chapters.
Okay. And what about in the show and tell, then you said to modify. Let's go into that area. And how do we really know what we should modify or not?
Okay. What we know about show and tell is tell is facts. Show is many things. Tell often creeps in during narrative where you have long blocks of he did this, he did that without anything behind it. It's sometimes caused by research and research excitement. We have a very good friend who's a writer, and sometimes she has long periods of where her research comes in big blocks. And it can happen in dialogue where one character is instructing another and goes into a monologue. Show is emotion, action, reaction, and using the senses. And remember, there are times when telling is effective, but only when used in short sentences. And when you start telling children's stories, think of the Three Little Pigs. That is a very short story, and it's mainly told. As a child grows older, they want to see what's happening. They want to know what the people are feeling. And that's what we mean by show, don't tell.
Yeah, I've heard it said that you should try to paint a narrative to show a picture rather than simply write a description. But to me, that advice is wrong, because a painted picture is static. Showing should never be static. A better analogy might be to try to create a movie or TV scene with your narrative, because those always show action.
So when you do your show and tell, then is this per chapter, per paragraph, per scene? How do you analyze?
Okay. I can give you a couple of little things. This is show. He prodded the horse with his heels. This is in the same paragraph. Tell. Soon the hut was far behind. Then this is show and tell. He prayed he'd find a sign of her trail, for the snow might cover her tracks, and he feared for her safety. So that show, you're showing how he prods the horse with his heels, and then you're telling that the hut that he'd been at was far behind. It's done sentence by sentence and paragraph, or the scene. Everything, you know, it builds.
Right, that makes sense. Let's talk a little bit about plot, and how do you know exactly where to start a story? I've seen people start stories before they were born.
We call it false start. If you started with a prologue, you have to think long and hard about whether to keep it or not, because unless the rest of the story is going to be heavily influenced by the prologue, you don't need it. A lot of people put a prologue in that is just backstory, and that it's dull, because you do have to start with action. The beginning of a story should contain a lot of elements, one of which is a hook, and the hook has to resonate throughout the first chapter. Just the hook isn't good enough. It has to be, don't forget there's a line and a sinker on a line to catch a fish. You have to develop the hook throughout the first chapter and on into the second, usually. There has to be an introduction or at least a hint of a main character's problem. There has to be some idea of time and place and possibly weather, because otherwise you have talking heads. You don't know where they are, or you can't have that. There should be no past history or flashbacks in the beginning of a book, and no long descriptive passages without action.
Yeah.
The story should begin with a main character poised on the brink of a change, or a moment after that change.
Yeah, and the one thing, and Jane and I both judge a lot of contests, and we will find somebody has this smashing first sentence or a terrific first paragraph, and then all of a sudden you see six or seven paragraphs of backstory blocked in, and you lose the reader there. You have to throw in any backstory in little bits and pieces throughout the story.
Right.
That's correct. Many people believe writers beginning writers tend to believe that you have to tell more about the characters in the first chapter. You don't. The characters reveal themselves as the book goes along and what they say and do. You don't need to be told. And that's a very common mistake with early writers.
Yeah, I've heard one technique is actually writing out the whole history of a character so you can get it out of your head and away from the book.
Well, that sounds like a good idea. Unfortunately, a lot of people then love that history so much that they put it into the book.
Yeah, but I don't know my characters that well. I mean, there's different ways of writing. The way I write is I know who my characters are, and I know what their problem is before I begin the book. But I don't know the characters. And I learn who they are in my first three chapters. So I can't explain it any better than that. They sort of tell me as I write who they are, and that's how I do characters.
Yeah, and I do it a little bit different. I don't know until I have the first rough draft what my characters are so that, you know, I know sort of what they are because I have decided what kind of a character I need. But I don't necessarily have to know their whole backstory until I'm into the book.
Yeah, that's essentially what I'm saying, too, you know. I don't need to know it. They are going to tell me.
Great. So at what point in the book would you introduce a flashback, and what are the proper motivations?
Okay, a flashback. All right, let's see. I have one book that has not a long flashback. It comes in about chapter 2, and the reason it's there is because one character sees another character who she remembers when they got off on the wrong foot. And it's about 3 or 4 paragraphs of this, and now she's going to have to work with him extensively so that you get into this. But I try to keep it as a minimum to show what her reaction and emotion was towards him during that time, because it will also point to what will happen to them during their present relationship and how it can change.
Well, I have the same type of thing that Janet does. I try to keep it short. And the story I'm writing right now, we have a little girl that was traumatized when she was a small child, and she keeps dreaming of it over and over. But when she finally never tells anybody about it because it's locked up within her. But when she finally does, I do it as a flashback, and it's way in the book.
Oh yeah, that makes sense. I guess that kind of leads me to another question, which I didn't even know I had, which is, how do you plan out foreshadowing, or is it something that just comes to you instinctively as a writer?
Well, my foreshadowing comes when all of a sudden something happens in the book that I didn't really plan, but it's logical and it's definitely happening. So I have to go back and put things in previous chapters to foreshadow that. I don't foreshadow ahead as a rule.
Yeah. I think that I work the same way as far as that goes, because all of a sudden, oh my goodness, is this what happens? Oh well, I got to go back and feed some lead into that.
Yeah.
And I don't know that I use foreshadowing as such. I try to weave it into the plot and into the story as it's going on.
Yes.
I don't get into these, you know, oh, she didn't know, you know. That's sort of foreshadowing.
That's author intrusion, anyway. Neither of us do that.
Right. Little did he know.
Yeah.
Now, the other end of the book, how do you know when to finish and how to finish?
That is hard. But usually there's something within me, and this is going to sound awful, whenever I say, if I go over this book one more time, I'm going to be very ill to my stomach, I know the book is done. I know that I can't do any more.
Yep. We better explain. Explain how many drafts you do.
Well, I usually do anywhere from 5 to 7 drafts, because I'm a draft writer, and this means going from beginning to end.
Oh.
And that's one way to write. I write the whole thing all the way through. I go back and edit the previous chapter before I go on to the next, but I only do one draft. And when the book ends, it's because all of the things that have happened in the book are resolved.
And the interesting thing, it probably takes us about the same amount of time to write the book.
Mm-hmm. It does.
Which sounds very strange, because it's like I'm doing it over and over again, but I'm finishing up the rough draft of a new project, and at this point in time, it's going to be around 80,000 words. It's 20,000 words, but this will grow as I write.
Well, when I'm writing the same thing, 80,000 words, it comes out at that at the end. So we do write differently, but it does take us about the same length of time. And it's, no way you write is wrong.
Yeah. I think everybody has to find their own rhythm. When I began writing, I must have read, easy 50 books on how to write. And I took a little from this and a little from that and played around until I found what worked for me. And what works for me might not work for anybody else.
That's right. And I just started writing. I didn't read any books. So I worked out my own way of doing it.
So there you go. It's just, you know, the two of you who actually have partnered on a book and yet write separately write totally different. And this is really encouraging to hear that what's important is really to find our own voice, as we had talked earlier, or the method of writing or whatever, as long as we start from the beginning and, you know, have an end and have a book. So it's how we get there. It's up to us and what works for us. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
That's exactly right. And the important thing, the very important thing that I tell every new writer is finish the book. Even if you finish a rough draft or if you have to finish the whole book, but finish it. Don't stop in the middle and jump to something else. The first book, when you finish, you feel accomplished. And then that keeps you writing.
Yes, that's true.
So is this would be the same for fiction and nonfiction?
Nonfiction is very different. It uses a whole different side of the brain.
Yeah.
And Jane and I, we can tell you, we struggled over. I think this book took us 2 years to write.
It did. It did. But then Janet would finish something and send it to me. I'd say, oh, gosh, I've got to do a chapter. So then I'd do. And we sort of pushed each other.
Yeah, I'm not, and it's funny, I'm reading through and I'm not sure which parts of each chapter. I know which ones we started out writing, but I would write it and send it to Jane and she would add her feedback and then I'd get it and clean it up or she would write the initial chapter and I would go through and organize it or do something to it, and so that it was a back and forth sort of thing. So we don't know who... where we began and where we started out.
I find that very interesting, and yet you were able to come up with a book that obviously won an award, and it's real helpful for all the people that really need to know how to become your own critique partner when you don't have somebody else to critique it. So
yes, an interesting thing is our publisher is using it for has given it to all their editors to use.
That's great.
Cool.
Yeah, and I've had a number of other writers say, yeah. I bought it, even though these are people that are published, because it may address something that they haven't, because I learn new things about writing every day.
We both learn new things about writing when we wrote it, too.
I bet you did. So let's go then into a dialogue. Of course, a lot of novels have dialogue. What should it do for the story?
Okay,
when
dialogue
to
me is very important, but part of dialogue is listening to other people talk and listen to the rhythm of the words. Dialogue is external or internal, and it's judged by word choice, by pacing, and by tone. And men and women tend to speak differently. Men tend to speak in shorter sentences than women. You try to carry this over to your dialogue. There are buzzwords in every profession, and I know we've probably all read books and the policeman says, oh, ma'am, please, I must arrest you, and you're saying, wait a minute, is this a police novel? You have to find out what the buzzwords are in the profession and use those. And pacing in dialogue if it's an emergency situation, people are going to use short words, hurry, run, rush. They're not going to have long, long sentences. So that you have to look at this. Tone is something that's hard to do without adverbs, but you can. You know, you can use characters' emotions. You can use punctuation. You can say, she looked at him with a sneer after she speaks, so that you can do it without using adverbs. And Jane, what do you have to add to this?
Well, I want to go back to showing and telling because it's important in dialogue, too. Having one character tell another character what they both already know is telling, not showing. And I see it in lots of books, some of them which are published. You can't do... Well, here's an example. They're after us, Rath said. Jill turned to look. Yeah, getting pretty close, too. Rath nodded. The mob never gives up. Those two are telling each other what they both already know. And you could say it this way. Is there only one hitman in the car? Rath asked. Jill turned to look. Damn, I make at least two. Could one be in the back as well? So that's showing. It tells the reader the same thing. It tells... She's asking a question. He tells her the bad news, but they're not telling what each other knows. So in dialogue, you've got to be careful not to have two characters sitting down, talking, telling each other what they know, or both of them already.
Yeah.
It has to be new information in a conversation.
Yeah. And your dialogue defines your characters.
Yes.
It tells you what your character is. It gives information, and it also helps carry the plot forward. Which it's important when you write to have your plot go forward.
It has to.
So as writers, do you actually take on the feelings of the character when you're writing and when you're writing the dialogue?
Sometimes. sometimes I do. Actually, I'm not sure because sometimes it's almost in some ways like automatic writing, and it's really not because I'm in control of it, but it's like I am writing this, and I know that I'm writing this, but I have to think, how does she feel? How is she going to react? This is her personality. This is what she would do. This is how she would say it.
Yeah,
so
but,
that
you feel the emotion, though, sometimes, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, I do, too.
You've written many, many, many stories. But I'm kind of thinking of, what about the new writers? They don't have that experience of just sitting down and having a dialogue. I would think that they would be the ones that would have to get into the character themselves and take on that character so they can create a dialogue. That is just my thinking, but I'd like some comments on that, if that's really that necessary for a new writer.
Okay, I work with some new writers. I belong to a critique group, and we have one very, very new writer and one who's not so much newer. And we have to spend a lot of time telling the one new writer, look, you know, your hero is a cop. He is not going to talk like that. Keep it short and simple. My friend has a good example. She had interviewed a policeman and she wanted to thank him, so she took a plant over to him and she walks in, he looks at the plant, he says, indoor or outdoor? That was all he said. it has nothing to do, it has to do with how much people read, as to whether I think if they don't read much, and you know, we have a lot of young people these days who don't read much, and they write books in text messaging.
Yep.
I think it depends. It depends upon the person themselves, and I don't think you can say this new writer needs this or this new writer needs that, because each one is unique.
That's right. When I judge in contests, I try to figure out why this particular contestant is doing that's wrong, and try to show her a way to change the way she's doing it. But you can't. It's a very difficult thing to tell somebody that this is wrong. You can see it, but how to do it is almost impossible to convey. I don't get it. I mean, I've acted in a few plays, and that's taking on a character. But I don't do that with my characters. As Janet says, I know I'm in control all the time. I can feel what the character feels. Because if I have the emotion, I can write the emotion a lot better and show it in the way she's acting than if I don't have it. But I'm always in control. I think a writer needs to do that. Otherwise, sometimes characters just simply get away from them.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Thanks for sharing with us your internal dialogue, as it were, on that. I heard you say a couple minutes ago something about adverbs being bad. I mean, instinctively, I know they are, but what cases are there when you want to use them?
There are times whenever you can use them, but a lot of times we read, I judge contests for new writers, people that are not published, and you will get, she said smilingly, she, and you'll get this every time they use said, there's an adverb tacked onto it. And that becomes ludicrous after a while. And sometimes they pick adjectives that are ludicrous to begin with. So this will bother it bothers the reader. It's not that you can't use them, but use them sparingly. Use them like a pinch of salt rather than the whole shaker.
Yeah, that's true. That's said very well. The other thing about modifying the said is you can often show how the character felt by instead of saying he said angrily, you say he fisted his hands, and then whatever he said, you know he's angry. You don't have to say he said angrily.
Right. He banged his hand on the table or whatever.
Yeah. The other thing with I don't know, this falls into the chapter on modifying is people describing themselves. They're not in front of a mirror, which is, of course, a cliche way to describe yourself. But I push back my auburn hair. Well, think about it. Nobody thinks about the color of the hair they're pushing back. You know, that's a mistake a lot of early new writers make, is trying to describe color, eye color and hair color and things like that in the actions of the character. You can't do it that way.
And I will say this, I probably made every mistake that was possible to make on my way up.
Oh, yeah, we all did. I mean, I think everybody does that. But we learned enough so we were able to write the book.
Yeah, that brings me to a question. What's the best way to physically describe when a new character comes on scene? I've heard the rule of thumb that you should only mention three things about them and let the reader's mind sort of fill in the rest. Do you have any rules on that?
I don't describe the new character when they come on as a rule. I have another character that's looking at them, and I stay in that other person's point of view. And then that other person can think, you know, I've never seen eyes quite that color. What would you call them? You know, that kind of thing. It's a lot easier if another character is describing a person.
Yeah, and I usually don't go on. I've seen books where they go on and on and on. A new character comes in, and the person who's looking at him describes him in 1,000 words or more, which is no fun. I usually try to keep, as you said, the rule of three. I usually try, it depends upon what kind of a character, because we have major characters, we have minor characters, and we have walk-on characters. If it's a walk-on character, I may just say the bus driver and not do any physical description. If it's a minor character, I may give them one trait. If it's going to be a major character, then I will give more, I will let the viewpoint character see more of it, of that person. So I think, I'm not sure that I use any rule of three. I think it depends upon the stature of the character as to how much space you give them.
Yeah, I guess that's right. If she's going to marry the busboy eventually, we can talk more about the busboy. Otherwise,
yeah,
he probably doesn't need a lot of description.
That's true.
All right. One last question on dialogue. I'm curious about internal versus external dialogue. How Do you have internal dialogue that doesn't make the character appear silly or indecisive?
Well, internal dialogue can be used to, to show that the person is thinking differently than what they're saying one thing, but they're not meaning another thing.
Oh.
And I pull out a couple little things here. The man says, "Nice perfume, my dear." It's nothing special. That's what she says. And then inside she thinks, that's twice he's my dear'd me. Does he think I'm Red Riding Hood? He's definitely a wolf. And then she says, "Where are we going?" He says, "To the movie." And so, sounds good. And then she inside says, "Shouldn't be too bad. At least they'd escape the summer heat." So that there's a difference between what she's saying and what she's thinking. And then sometimes the internal dialogue expands on what someone says out loud. And sometimes they say things that they don't want to say, or they are debating. You have internal dialogue where someone is debating with themselves.
Yeah. Okay, that makes sense.
So, Jane, you have anything to add to that?
Well, I was just thinking in mysteries it's quite common for the lead character who's going to solve the mystery in the end to have an internal dialogue with himself about the characters, and I mean about the suspects. That's another way that it's often used.
Oh, yeah.
Gosh, I have so many more questions, but unfortunately we're just running out of time, Jane and Janet. Gosh, what is your website address?
My website is, I go to www.bookswelove, and I think it's walters.htm.
Okay.
And mine is just www.janetombs, .com.
Great. Well, I just want to thank both of you so much for showing up on Authors Access and giving us all this insight. And as I say, I've got questions, and you really have me thinking. I just never heard of the show until before, so this is new to me, and it makes so much sense. And, of course, your comments about dialogue and everything else have been just so helpful and really is raising a lot of questions for me and my own writing. So thank you again for showing up. It's just been wonderful talking to you.
Well, I enjoyed it.
Yes, and thank you for having us.
Yes, we both say so.
And you've been listening to another podcast edition of Authors Access, where authors get published and published authors get successful. We'll be back on the air Thursday, June 28th, 2007, when our topic will be all the ins and outs of book reviews. And our guest who will be joining us is Irene Watson. And we'll be introducing special guest co-host Tyler Tischler, who will be appearing on several upcoming shows. You can learn more about our guest on the Authors Access website, which is authorsaccess.com. Authors Access is a joint production of Reader Views Incorporated and Loving Healing Press.
And for Reader Views, this is Irene Watson of Austin, Texas, signing off.
This is Victor Volkman from Ann Arbor, Michigan, wishing you all a good evening.